Hello, it's the 12th of November and welcome to our Friday edition of Career 24. I'm your host, Kwon Jang-woo. An independent panel of experts has been launched in Korea to analyze the possible link between COVID-19 vaccines and adverse side effects. We'll have more details in our news briefing shortly. Later on this week's weekly economy review, we'll take a look at the latest job figures, the possibility of another round of COVID-19 relief payouts, and the US's controversial request for data from Korean chip makers. And then for Movie Spotlight, we'll be bringing details of the latest London Korean Film Festival, which this year will feature a special program of films celebrating Yoon Yeo-jung, the Oscar-winning actress. Let's begin Career 24. South Korea launched an advisory panel on Friday to analyze the possible link between COVID-19 vaccines and adverse effects. Meanwhile, the nation saw record numbers of critically ill patients for a third consecutive day. To give us the details, our KBS World Radio news editor, Koo Hee-jin, joins us on the line now. Hee-jin, hello.
Hello, Jang-woo.
Let's first talk about this independent panel. It hopes to determine the causality between vaccines and side effects reported by those who received vaccination to address public concerns. Can you give us more details about this panel?
Yes, well, the Vaccine Safety Committee, consisting of 22 members from the National Academy of Medicine of Korea, will conduct a comprehensive review of local and overseas cases and clinical studies to set scientific standards that will serve as guidelines on vaccine safety. We should note that there is an existing compensation committee to evaluate causality in specific cases. This new panel will paint a bigger picture by reviewing results from a wider cross-section of the population. New findings from the safety committee, however, could overturn previous findings from the compensation panel. Meanwhile, the Korea Disease Control and Prevention Agency reported 2,368 additional cases on Friday, bringing the cumulative total to 390,719. The number of critically ill patients climbed to a fresh high for a third day to 475, raising concerns that the nation is not yet ready to move on to the next phase of living with COVID-19.
And as part of efforts to tackle the pandemic, the government has been encouraging its local drug makers to develop treatment for COVID-19. Now we have word that the European Union's drug watchdog has recommended the authorization of a COVID-19 antibody treatment made by a South Korean biopharmaceutical company called Celltrion for people at risk of severe disease. Can you tell us more?
Yes, the European Medicines Agency gave the green light on Thursday for Celltrion's Recurona, along with Ronapreve, manufactured by Swiss pharmaceutical giant Roche, with U.S. biotech firm Regeneron. This marks the first approval for a monoclonal antibody treatment in Europe. The EU regulator said Recurona should be made available only for adults who don't yet require oxygen support but are at risk of becoming critically ill. Regeneron was recommended for treating adults and adolescents over the age of 12 with similar conditions. Meanwhile, Prime Minister Kim Buk-yeom apologized for breaking social distancing protocols and vowed never to repeat such an incident. Kim, who is heading the nation's efforts to clamp down on the spread of the virus, attended a luncheon of 11 people last Saturday after one of his party was unexpectedly accompanied by his wife. This breached a rule that limits private gatherings to 10 in the Seoul metro area. The Jongno District Office later said it will receive quarantine violation reports from all 11 people, including the Prime Minister, and impose fines of up to 100,000 won each, or about $85.
Let's move on to other headlines now. In the latest developments in the presidential race, candidates of the two main parties locked horns over diplomacy as both began tackling issues on international relations and met with overseas delegates. So what issues did they address then, Hee-jin?
Well, in a Facebook post on Friday, ruling Democratic Party's Lee Jae-myung took issue with an earlier pledge made by his main rival, Yoon Sung-yeol of the People Power Party, after the latter promised to reaffirm a 1998 joint declaration with Japan as a way to improve bilateral relations. Lee slammed Yoon, saying that today's Japan is not the same as when that declaration was adopted, and that the country has since swung to the far right. Meanwhile, the PPP blasted Lee, saying that it was shocking to see how he blatantly expressed anti-US sentiment while meeting a visiting U.S. Senate delegation, calling it a diplomatic gaffe. Meeting with U.S. Senator John Ossoff on Friday, Lee said Korea was annexed to Japan because the U.S. condoned the move through the 1905 Taft-Katsura Agreement.
Meanwhile, President Moon Jae-in will attend a virtual Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Summit later on Friday and discuss ways to streamline global supply chains to accelerate a post-COVID-19 economic recovery. Can you elaborate more on the agenda?
Well, this 28th APEC summit, which is set to begin at 8 p.m. Korean local time, will focus on coordinating within the group to speed up the recovery process, key opportunities and challenges, and how to ensure equal gains. Participants will discuss ways to overcome the prevailing health crisis, cooperate on climate and environment, and promote sustainable development. President Moon will outline Korea's plans to ensure a steady global supply network, as well as its blueprint for a digital transition. He will also explain South Korea's contribution to global efforts to fight the pandemic, such as vaccine donations to low-income nations. After the summit, the leaders plan to adopt the Putrajaya Vision 2040, an action plan for the APEC to strengthen trade and investment and seek sustainable and inclusive growth in the Asia-Pacific region by 2040.
Moving on, Jin Air, one of the nation's largest low-cost carriers, suffered a passenger service system error on Friday, causing delays in boarding and ticket issuance at airports around the country. Can you tell us more?
Yes, the malfunction first detected at around 6:30 led to delays in the flight departures, forcing the company to send most of its employees to airports nationwide to help manually issue tickets. Among a total of 126 flights planned, 42 flights were delayed by more than an hour, while 15 were cancelled. The company said the issue was fully resolved as of 4:40 p.m. on Friday.
And finally, South Korea's police plan to set up massive blockades to prevent mass gatherings at a rally hosted by a major umbrella union in Seoul on Saturday. Can you give us more details?
Yes, well, the Korean National Police Agency on Friday said that it plans to mobilize forces across the country to prevent gatherings and disperse crowds in accordance with rally and infectious disease prevention laws. Those using physical force against law enforcement will be arrested on site, and organizers of illegal rallies will face criminal charges. This comes amid news that the Korean Confederation of Trade Unions is pushing ahead with plans to stage an illegal rally involving tens of thousands of people, despite bans by the police and the Seoul Metropolitan Government. Following the nation's transition into a system of living with the virus, the KCTU reported plans to hold 20 separate rallies, each consisting of 499 people, throughout central Seoul to meet with distancing restrictions. The city government, however, rejected the plan, considering it a single rally involving 10,000 people.
That wraps up our news briefing today. Thank you for those updates, Heejin.
Thank you.
It's time now for our Friday in-depth analysis segment, Weekly Economy Review. Today we'll be looking closer at South Korea's job gains last month, which saw more than 600,000 on-year growth for the second consecutive month. We'll also check in on another round of COVID-19 relief payouts that are being talked about in political circles, as well as discuss the controversial requests made by the US for data from Korean chip makers. To help us to look over all of these issues today, we have once again joining us in the studio, economics professor Yang Jun-suk from the Catholic University of Korea. Professor Yang, thank you for being with us today.
Happy to be here.
So first off, let's get an update on the Korean stock markets as usual. Professor, how did the KOSPI and KOSDAQ fare this week?
Okay, well, KOSPI closed today at 2,968.80. It went up 1.5% just today, so it was a very good day. But it wasn't a great week. The entire week, it was mostly downward, except a slight rise on Tuesday, and it fell more than 1% on Wednesday. So it was looking to be a very bad week, except we had a really big recovery today. And for the week, it fell only 0.03%. KOSDAQ, it's almost the opposite story of KOSPI. It closed today at 1,009.07. It went up 1.65% just today. But KOSPI had a great week. It rose almost every day this week except on Wednesday. And for the week as a whole, it went up by 0.77% because on Wednesday it had a large decline of more than 2%. Mm. But still, they had a positive week for the week as a whole. U.S. dollar, it closed today at 1,180.00. It hit a highest point on Monday, then it started falling for the rest of the week, so it appreciated for most of the week. For the entire week, it appreciated by 0.44%.
Okay, moving on Wednesday, it was announced in October, more than 600,000 jobs were added on year for the second consecutive month. According to Statistics Korea, the number of employed individuals reached 27.74 million last month, up 652,000 from a year earlier. The agency also revealed that the jobless rate decreased 0.9 percentage points on year to 2.8% last month, the lowest figure for the month of October since 2013. So, Professor, what do you make of the latest job data? What factors contributed to the job gains?
Okay, well, the number of jobs and the unemployment rate, it was definitely a lot better than a year ago. But problem is we're comparing it to October 2020 numbers. And in October 2020, we were in the midst of the coronavirus recession practically. So it really doesn't make a very good comparison. If you look at the comparison with last year, in all ages, employment rate rose higher, and the employment rate went up to 61.4%. That was up 1.0 percentage point. So it seems like a great month. But personally, I've been comparing it to 2019 numbers. Mm. 2019 wasn't a great year for Korea, but it was a normal year before the coronavirus. Mm. And if we compare that, in terms of raw numbers, we're doing very well. Hmm. In terms of quality of jobs, we're not doing very well. So in terms of number of jobs, 2021 is higher than 2019. In terms of number of unemployed, 2021 is lower than 2019. So we definitely made some improvement there. Employment rate, 2021 is slightly lower. And that's because we have more number of workers than 2 years ago. But still, it's roughly comparable. It's 61.4% now. It was 61.7% 2 years ago. And unemployment rate is down compared to 2 years ago. So again, it looks pretty good. But if you compare age groups, you begin to see some big difference. Mm. 15 to 29-year-olds, employment rate is currently higher. 44.3% in 2019 versus 45.1% currently. And over 60, employment rate is also currently higher. But 30 to 39-year-olds, 40 to 49-year-olds, they're significantly lower right now. In 2019, 40-year-olds were 78.5% employment rate. Now it's only 77.7%. So if you look at the people in prime working ages, they're doing worse now than 2 years ago. 50 to 59-year-olds, it's almost the same. It's slightly higher this year. If you look at full-time jobs except part-time jobs, it really collapsed this month or in October this year.
Okay, what do you mean?
The full-time jobs for 2021 October was 16.6 million, and this was down 21.2% compared to last year when the job market wasn't very good. Mm-hmm. In 2019, we had 22.2 million people in full-time jobs. So if you compare it back with then the difference is about 6 million people. If you look at just 36 to 52-hour workweek jobs, it fell by 22.2% compared to 2020. And if you look at part-time jobs, well, most of the job growth took place with job hours from 18 to 35 hours per week. That rose by 132% compared to 2020. So it seems like a lot of full-time jobs shifted into part-time jobs. So in terms of quality of jobs, it seems to have fallen significantly, particularly in October, because the statistics weren't this bad in September.
Right, so the headline number of more jobs looks encouraging, but beneath the surface, there are some concerning signs. Why are the quality of the jobs not as good as it should be?
Okay, well, if you look at the number of types of jobs which rose, most of the job growth took place in health and social services sector. That's basically government finance jobs. That rose by 300,000. But transportation and warehousing jobs, that rose by 136,000. Mostly is home delivery type of jobs which rose. And most home delivery jobs, they're not really full-time jobs. You know, they're people delivering goods. So that seems to have a lot to do with it. Where the numbers fell, it was in wholesale and retail jobs and personal services, probably because of distancing measures. And manufacturing jobs, there's not that big a difference between last month and this month. Last month, it did fall significantly. And that partially is because of the supply bottleneck that we've been talking about. The supply of intermediate goods have not been enough to support the manufacturing jobs.
So long term, there are concerns that perhaps need to be watched. Let's look at another major headline from this week. Lee Jae-myung, the presidential candidate of the ruling Democratic Party, has floated the idea of providing another round of COVID-19 disaster relief funds to everyone in Korea. In line with Lee's idea, the DP said on Tuesday that it would push for handouts between 200,000 and 250,000 won. That's about 170 to 210 US dollars. And that would be given out to all citizens around January. Meanwhile, on the other side of the political aisle, the main opposition People Power Party's presidential candidate, Yoon Sung-yeol, has proposed spending 50 trillion won to compensate the self-employed and small business owners hit by the coronavirus pandemic. However, the finance minister, Hong Nam-ki, said yesterday that all such proposals are not easy to carry out, adding that thorough assessments need to be made to see if they are financially feasible. So, Professor, what do you make of these proposals, and do you think they're necessary?
Okay, neither of these proposals seem particularly to be a good idea.
Okay.
For Lee Jae-myung's universal relief payment, it's likely to be unnecessary and ineffective because, well, we're supposed to be in the recovery stage. For Yoon Sung-yeol's compensation, while everybody agrees that more aid should be given to small firms which have been hurt, there's big question on whether 50 trillion won is the correct amount. And his proposal says that he will fully compensate the losses. And again, while there should be more compensation, whether it should be full compensation is up to question because there's some problems when you give full compensation of these type of losses. But let's start with the universal relief payment, or as the Democratic Party retitled it, quarantine support payment. Apparently, they retitled it because it didn't poll well with the electorate. And the amount is... if they go with the 200,000 to 250,000 won per person, it should be about 10 to 12 million won. And that's less than what candidate Lee Jae-myung wanted, which would have cost 25 trillion won. The reason that I say this probably won't be effective is that if we go back to last month, in September, when they gave out the second universal relief payment, retail sales rose about 2.5%, which is admittedly better than September 2020 or August 2021. Mm. But considering that September had Chuseok, and a second universal relief payment as well, and this 2.5% growth took place against August, not September last year. So the rise of only 2.5% is nothing great, and it was a bit disappointing compared, considering that we had Chuseok and the relief payment.
We should just clarify as well, you say universal, but it wasn't completely universal.
Yeah, it was about 80 to 85% of the population. If you compare that with 2020 May and June, when they had the first truly universal relief payment, that went up by, in May, 3.5%, in June, 2.6%. So it was lower than the first universal relief payment. And even that, after a KDI study, said that it was only about 30% effective because people only spent about 30% of the money that they did get. Now, the reason that Vice Prime Minister Hong Nam-ki is so concerned is that the Democratic Party wanted to use windfall taxes to finance this relief payment. But by law, most of that money is already allocated. So they can only use perhaps 3 to 4 trillion won, and then they would have to issue debt for the rest. That is right now considered poison politically. So National Assembly wanted to bypass the law which allocates the windfall taxes by delaying the deadline for this year's taxes to next year, when they think that they can have more freedom to use the money for this type of relief payment. But again, it seems like the taxes that they can delay is things like the real estate taxes or some year-end taxes. That only, again, comes down to about 3 to 4 trillion won. So if they really want to do this, they'll either have to ignore the law entirely or they'll have to issue debt. Now, for Yoon Suk-yeol's party, he states 50 trillion won should be allocated, but he doesn't exactly state where that 50 trillion won, how it was calculated. And some of his supporters were saying this, he doesn't actually mean he's going to spend 50 trillion won, but that's the upper limit. But it doesn't seem like they really calculated how much this would take. In the second supplementary budget, they budgeted 3 trillion won for assistance to small companies. In the 2022 budget, they also calculated about 3 trillion won. So this will be a multiple of that, almost 10 times the amount that they've allocated. And then the 50 trillion won is about 9% of 2021 budget, and it's about 2.5% of Korean GDP for 2020. Now, in 2020, with the coronavirus, the growth rate was minus 0.9%. So you're having a supplementary budget of 2.5% of GDP to compensate loss of 0.9% of GDP. And if you give full compensation to all losses, that means people who really tried very hard to minimize their losses get compensated less. Whereas people who didn't do anything and let the losses build up, they get compensated more. That doesn't exactly speak about wise incentive policy.
So you're not on board with either proposal. But there are some quarters that say the government has should be loosening the purse strings a bit more during the pandemic, especially when you make comparisons with other major economies. Very briefly, do you think that criticism is fair?
No, because, well, United States spent more per person, but first of all, they're richer. Second of all, they don't have health insurance infrastructure like Korea does. And their labor market is much more flexible, so that more people were actually fired. Japan, similarly, they're richer than Korea, so their relief payment should be more than Korea. But overall, the only countries which gave out universal or nearly universal relief payment was U.S., Singapore, Japan, and Korea. Europeans didn't give out any relief payment to everybody. So that argument, I think, is misplaced.
We're short on time. Let's look at one more topic to squeeze in today. Domestic chip makers Samsung Electronics and SK Hynix submitted semiconductor data to the U.S. government on Monday. That's because in late September, the U.S. Commerce Department asked global semiconductor manufacturers to fill out essentially a questionnaire about the supply chain involving inventory data, sales, orders and client information. However, the two Korean firms reportedly excluded sensitive information such as client information. The U.S. Department of Commerce has asked major chip makers to voluntarily to submit this information, but Korea, as he said, has reneged on some of it. The Trade Minister Moon Sung-wook assured that the U.S.'s move to request such data is just a one-time measure. But what should we read into this, Professor? What do you make of this whole situation?
Well, I think the United States really wants to get a very clear picture on where the bottleneck is coming from. And in order to do that, they need to know where the supply is coming from and who's buying it. And not only semiconductors as a whole, but what type of semiconductors, because it's really certain types of semiconductors which are causing all the bottlenecks. And because they want to get a clearer picture of how everything is sort of flowing down the line. So I think at least some components of that information is actually required, and the United States is using national defense-related laws to get that information. Now, Korean firms do have a reputation of not handing out some necessary information because they want to keep a lot of it secret. Some accuse Korea of hiding information because they want to hide some, if not illegalities per se, then at least some questionable activities concerning antitrust or competition law policy, pressuring the suppliers or customers when they're the only supplier or buyer. But I think United States will continue to ask for information as long as this bottleneck situation lasts, because, well, they want to get some idea on why some critical parts, which may not be expensive or highest technology parts, are not reaching America's shores. So until the bottleneck situation is over, I think they're going to keep on asking for more information.
We'll wrap it up there for our weekly economy review. Thank you for that analysis, Professor, and we'll see you again next time.
Thank you.
Welcome to the Korea 24 Stock and Forex Update. The benchmark Korea Composite Stock Price Index rose 43.88 points, or 1.50% on Friday, closing the week at 2,968.80. The tech-heavy KOSDAQ also rose, gaining 16.42 points, or 1.65%, to close at 1,009.07. On the foreign exchange, the local currency strengthened 1.21 against the dollar, ending the day at 1,179.6 won. You can check Korean stock and forex closings at world.kbs.co.kr.
Next up, it's our daily segment, Korea Trending. This is where we take a look at some of the other news stories and headlines that people have been looking up online in Korea today. And our contributor, Walter Lee, is in the studio with us. Walter, hello. It's good to see you.
Hello, Jenga. How are you today?
I'm good, thank you. So what topics have you brought for us today?
Okay, so we'll talk about the U.S. Embassy in Seoul's pledge to cooperate with the police probe on a U.S. diplomat's alleged hit and run. We'll also discuss South Korea's latest victory in the Asian qualifying round for the 2022 FIFA World Cup. And finally, we'll find out which national treasures have been put on permanent display at the National Museum of Korea in an exclusive exhibition room.
Okay, so we're starting with something that could be a minor diplomatic incident. Can you tell us more?
Yeah, so the U.S. Embassy in Seoul has vowed to closely cooperate with local police on suspicions that one of its diplomats took part in a hit-and-run incident. A foreign ministry official told reporters on Friday that the U.S. conveyed via diplomatic channels that it will closely work with local authorities on the incident in line with due process, saying it understands the sensitivity of the matter. The ministry said it has requested the U.S. for support on the latest case via various channels. The diplomat is currently being questioned by police.
Okay, so can you tell us a bit more about what happened exactly? What is the U.S. diplomat suspected of doing?
Well, according to police, a vehicle driven by the diplomat, who was accompanied by three others, is suspected of rear-ending a taxi while changing lanes near Seoul's Namsan No. 3 tunnel Wednesday afternoon. Instead of dealing with the incident, the diplomat fled to the nearby Yongsan Garrison. The taxi driver gave chase, but was blocked by U.S. forces Korea officials. The diplomat and the passengers refused to cooperate when the police arrived at the garrison gate. They declined to open the vehicle windows or take a breathalyzer test and then went on base. After confirming through the foreign ministry that the driver is a U.S. diplomat, the police sent an official request to the embassy for cooperation.
So what has the embassy said in response to this incident so far?
It has simply said that in a statement on Thursday that it does not agree with media reports about the latest incident and that it is confident that the government will and law enforcement authorities will thoroughly and fairly look into the case. It then added that it will refrain from providing any further explanations on the matter until the investigation is over.
Well, what's remarkable about this incident is that all of this was allegedly recorded on the taxi's dash cam, right, which has been shown on news outlets now here in Korea. And the car is clearly seen driving away after refusing to stop despite the taxi honking its horn after this alleged incident. The taxi driver is even seen at one point getting out of his taxi and knocking on the car window while waiting in traffic, but the driver refused to get out. It is, from the video, seems like rather damning evidence, and we certainly do hope that the U.S. Embassy does indeed cooperate with the local authorities on what could have been just a minor accident turning into a bigger diplomatic controversy. Okay, let's move on. What else do you have for us today?
Okay, so South Korea is aiming to head to the World Cup for the 10th consecutive time after defeating the United Arab Emirates, or the UAE, 1-0 in a World Cup Asian qualifier on Thursday. Hwang Hee-chan netted the only goal of the game with a penalty in the 36th minute at Goyang Stadium in Gyeonggi Province. With the victory, Team Korea is still safe in second place in Group A in the final Asian qualifying round for the 2022 FIFA World Cup. Iran still leads the pack with 13 points in the group, with South Korea at 11. But the two are still well ahead of the rest, as third place Lebanon has only 5 points. The UAE now has scored 3 draws and the 2 losses following its match with Team Korea.
Yes, it was a tight 1-0 result, but actually it was very one-sided, with Korea taking 22 shots compared to the UAE's 4, and Korea even hit the woodwork 3 times.
Right.
It was arguably Korea's best performance in these qualifiers, despite the scoreline, which was encouraging to see. Okay, so what's next for Korea then? Who do they play next?
So that would be Iraq, which sits in fourth place of Group A. The match is slated to be held next Wednesday at Doha in Qatar. The Taeguk Warriors, led by coach Paulo Bento, will depart for Doha on Sunday after taking a 2-day rest.
Right, and can you remind us what Korea needs to do in these qualifiers to make it to Qatar 2022?
Okay, so there are 2 groups of 6, and the top 2 teams from each will earn a direct berth to the 2022 World Cup in Qatar. Teams in third place of the groups will have to face each other, and the winner of that will play in a last-chance intercontinental playoff.
Yes, so Korea are well on their way to Qatar and will hoping to further cement that place against Iraq on Wednesday. Let's move on to our final story of the day now. What do you have for us?
So our final story of the day is the National Museum of Korea began putting on permanent display the renowned pensive Bodhisattva's statue, also known as the 2-gilt bronze Maitreya's in meditation. The museum opened a room of quiet contemplation from Friday to exhibit the statues, which are both national treasures and representative items of the museum. Previously, they were displayed alternately, with the exception of 3 special exhibitions where they were shown together.
Yes, we've in fact talked about these two national treasures before, back when it was originally announced that they would finally get their own personal exhibition. I recall the museum's director general imagining the exhibit to be like the Mona Lisa at the Louvre. Well, they're finally here, and that dream has come into fruition. Can you tell us a bit more about the exhibition itself?
Sure. So designed by architect Che Uk, a room of quiet contemplation allows visitors to have a 360-degree view of the seated Bodhisattvas in a hall that can be described as minimalistic with a blend of modern and traditional elements. Lighting really sets the tone as the walls themselves resemble traditional red clay. The room, nearly 440 square meters, is located at the Permanent Exhibition Gallery on the museum's second floor. The museum said it hopes that Buddha statues displayed in an exclusive facility to become its key collection, as well as one of the nation's representative cultural assets.
And can you tell us about the two pieces themselves as well?
Yeah, so one of the statues, measuring 81.5 centimetres, is estimated to have been made in the late 6th century, while the other statue, nearly 91 centimetres tall, is assessed to have been made in the 7th century. Admission is free, but the museum could limit entry if the room draws large crowds.
Okay, that's all for Korea Trending today. Thank you for bringing us those stories, Walter, and we'll see you next week.
See you next week.
We've come now to our weekly Friday segment, Movie Spotlight, reviewing the latest releases at the Korean box office and online, and chatting about Korean cinema in general. This week we have just one guest today, and that is Darcy Paquette, a figure esteemed enough, though, to comfortably fill two guest slots. Darcy, it's great to see you again.
Yeah, good to be here, Jang-ho.
This week, we are not going with our regular film reviews because halfway around the world, the biggest annual showcase of Korean cinema outside of Korea is currently underway, and that is the London Korean Film Festival. It is now in its 16th year, and Darcy today is going to be telling us all about it, especially because, full disclosure, he is personally involved this year as well, despite unable to be there physically. So, Darcy, can you first give us a general introduction to this year's event?
Yeah, I mean, the festival, it had its opening gala last week, November 4th, and it had a special screening of Escape from Mogadishu, which we talked about in this program, and which is kind of great for an opening film. And then it wraps up a week from today with the closing film, which is Heaven to the Land of Happiness. And this is the film that opened the Busan Film Festival. And yeah, I mean, after those, there are a couple additional screenings that take place in Manchester and Glasgow as well. I mean, this year is kind of a return for the festival because although it was held last year, it was mostly online with just a few offline screenings. And this year it's all in theaters. So that's, I mean, a good thing to see. The program is really quite wide ranging. And so they go from mainstream commercial features to independent films and documentaries and short films, animation, even artist videos. So there's a lot to see for people who are in London.
Yes, that is what is quite striking about this festival, that it does showcase a very impressive variety each year, I think, and it's great to see it back in the theatres this time. In terms of programming this year, though, what stands out most for you?
I think that the section that really stands out is the special focus on Yoon Ya-jung, who, of course, won Best Supporting Actress Oscar earlier this year. And they're screening five of her feature films. Going all the way back to like her 1971 classic Woman of Fire by Kim Gi-yeon. There's a special documentary on her work there. And it's really kind of a wide range of her performances. And so it includes independent films like The Bacchus Lady and then also Canola, which is kind of more of a mainstream melodrama. So you can see kind of the full range of her acting skills.
Definitely. Many might only have gotten to know her through her Oscar-winning performance in Minari, but she has a long and varied career. Hopefully this retrospective will show that. Usually the festival has been known for flying in many guests from Korea, but I understand Yoon herself will not be attending this year.
Yeah, I mean, it is difficult. I mean, even though it's back in theaters, I think that, you know, to bring in international guests is much more complicated and difficult. But the director Im Sang-soo will be flying in to to meet with audiences at the festival. And, you know, he directed two films that made Yoon Yeo-jung really famous. There was A Good Lawyer's Wife from 2003, and then The Housemaid from 2010. So he'll be there in person for those screenings. Mm. And then he also directed the closing film, Heaven. So he's kind of representing a number of different films when he's there. And then there's another director who's coming in person, who is the independent director, Kim Jong-gwan, who shot the film Jose, which we discussed on the program last December. I mean, there are some other Q&As, but those are going to be either kind of virtual or, you know, they're pre-recorded interviews that they'll be kind of screening for audiences.
Yeah, it's a shame that Yoon won't be there, especially after she charmed British audiences with her acceptance speech at the BAFTAs this year with her tongue-in-cheek ribbing of British snobbishness. But audiences will still have plenty to enjoy from those films. Perhaps, what would your highlight be for looking at the lineup for Yoon Yeo-jung's films?
I don't know. I mean, her older films are really good. I mean, A Good Lawyer's Wife is quite an intense film. I mean, I rewatched it recently, and, you know, in 2003, I think audiences were a little more used to films that were really shocking in moments and that kind of came out and shook you by the throat unexpectedly. And then rewatching it now, it is kind of surprising because I think that the film industry has grown a little bit more tame in recent years. But, you know, her performance in that too, it has all of her kind of verve and her energy that, you know, she brings to her performances. But then also, I mean, you know, going back to 1971, Kim Gi-young is just completely unique as a director. He was very odd. I'm sure that in person he must have been an unusual character, but, you know, his films are really worth checking out. Mm. So, I mean, for me, the older ones, although, I mean, all of her performances are great.
What do you make of the lineup of the festival this year as well? We've talked about Escape from Mogadishu before, and then this closing film as well, we've talked about briefly when we talked about the Busan Film Festival. Those are two pretty big films to begin and end with.
Yeah, it's not always easy to get those kind of films, especially these days. Like, I know that some festivals, particularly those that kind of highlight more genre films or mainstream cinema, have been really struggling in the past year and a half because, you know, the big films in Korea have not been released in theaters. They've been held back. And there are independent films and smaller films and kind of art house films that have been released into the festival circuit. But it's impressive that they're able to get these two big films because they do really feel like an event. I think choosing a film for the opening is different for any other kind of programming because you get, you know, a big audience and you get festival sponsors and everything else. And but you want a film that kind of excites people and starts off the festival and with everybody in a good mood. And so in that sense, it's the perfect choice.
Yeah, really starting off with a bang there. Now, Darcy, you have become quite involved in this festival personally. I remember we actually connected with you 2 years ago while you were in London, where you were giving, I believe, a talk about the history of Korean cinema. But you've become even more involved now, right?
Yeah, as time has gone on, they've pulled me a little bit more and more in, which is great with me. And I mean, initially for a number of years, I was just writing for the festival catalog and, you know, different essays, or I was translating stuff for them. And then 2019 was my first trip to London. That was also the year for the 100-year anniversary of Korean cinema. So I was able to talk a bit about some older films and to join a panel discussion. And, you know, what really impressed me, I think, was, the ambition and the scope of the festival. So I left it hoping to work more with them. And so luckily last year they contacted me and asked me to choose 6 films for a special section, which was called Friends and Family. And the idea was that during the pandemic, you know, people had kind of came to see, I mean, their relationships with people all changed as we were living through that. And so we looked at films that, you know, examine friendships and family, not always from kind of a warm, feel-good kind of perspective. Some of these are a bit darker films, but we showed movies like Family Ties from Kim Tae-yong in 2006, and a movie called Juvenile Delinquent from 2012, which I really like, and it was good to kind of bring it out. And screen it once again.
Mm.
And then a couple of recent films, including Moving On, which was one of my favorite films from 2019. So this year they asked me to program four films for a special section devoted to independent cinema. And so for that one, I just watched a ton of recent films, you know, the films that had debuted in Busan and Chunju in the past year. And then, picked four of my favorites.
Okay, so which four films did you select in the end, and why these films specifically?
Yeah, I mean, sometimes when you're programming, there's a special theme. And in this case, there was no theme. And so, I mean, my instincts usually are to try to show kind of a spectrum of different, I don't know, different voices and different perspectives, and try to make a balance. And, you know, some of the films that I was interested in showing ended up not being available. A couple of them ended up screening in other sections in the festival. Like there's a movie, Aloners, which I really like and would have put in my section, but it was already programmed for the festival. And so my final choices were Lime Crime. Lime Crime is actually opening in Korean theaters fairly soon. It's about two middle school boys who are into hip hop. But, you know, one of them's from a really rich family and the other one, it's from a really poor family, and they bond over music. But, you know, their partnership and their team kind of goes through these challenges as well. But that's a really good film just to kind of see this youth culture connected around hip hop. There was a movie called Rolling, which is set during the pandemic. And it's about a woman in her 20s who is asked by her mother to help out at her kimbap store. It's a really simple story, but it's one of those movies that the actors are kind of allowed to really showcase their talent, and it pulls you in slowly so that by the end of the film, it's really moving. Made on the Rooftop is a romantic comedy. It's about two gay men who are both going through difficult periods in their various relationships. And it was just a lot of fun. It has Lee Jung-un from Parasite in a really memorable role as well.
Right, okay.
And then the last film is called Awoke, which it's interesting because it grew out of a workshop for disabled people who were interested in filmmaking. So there was a filmmaker who went down to Jeju Island and, you know, had this workshop, and one of the participants, who was a disabled man in a wheelchair, really wanted to continue working with film. And so he wrote a screenplay based on partly his experiences, partly other experiences that he'd heard about, and partly using his imagination. And the two of them ended up co-directing this film together.
Wow.
So it opened in Chunju last year. And I believe this is the first international screening of the film. But it's quite dark, actually. But definitely worth checking out.
Well, it sounds like a fascinating selection, and perhaps we will be talking about some of these soon as well when they do get a more widespread release here. You must be sad that you can't be there to see it yourself and see how audiences react, especially because the festival does draw in quite an audience, doesn't it?
It does. I mean, that really impressed me when I was there, that, you know, I think over the years they've built up this audience, and that's a key thing for film festivals. If, you know, it's creating kind of this long-term relationship with your audience, so that they look forward to it every year, and the audience kind of grows bigger and bigger each year. But there are a lot of people there who are really knowledgeable about Korean cinema, even some people who've never been to Korea themselves, but they, you know, have picked up this interest. Yeah, I mean, I would have loved to have gone. It's not really possible right now, given my workload and everything else, but I'm kind of cheering along from the sidelines here in Seoul.
Well, I'm sure your presence will be felt and people will appreciate the program that you've put together. For more information about the festival and what will be shown, listeners can go to the website, which is simply koreanfilm.co.uk. Darcy, we'll wrap it up there. Thank you for coming in today and telling us all about it.
Yeah, see you next time.
It's time now for us to wrap up the week by looking ahead to what's happening next week in our Friday closing segment next week from Seoul. And for that, we have our staff editor, Mark Wilson-Che, joining us now in the studio. Mark, hello. It's good to see you.
Good to see you too.
So what are we looking at first for next week?
As you covered before, Suning, or the College Scholastic Ability Test, is set for next Thursday. You talked about the exam conditions and measures yesterday, and they can easily be found online and in English too, or just look, look you up on the internet as well, listen to us. But while the COVID-19 pandemic will change test-taking conditions, some things won't change. For example, work hours will be adjusted in some companies, and during the listening test, planes will not take off or land. Now, I have experience with taking the SATs, but Suning is just something else completely. I just talked about how we can't fly planes, you know, during the listening test. I actually have a friend who is a homeroom teacher of high school girls, and she said that she's stressed as well as a teacher because it's like her children, and their futures are determined. And
sure.
I just imagine the day that the test results come out as well. So, good luck to all the test takers out there.
Yes, definitely, especially as they've had to prepare amid the pandemic situation as well. It's stressful enough, even without all that, of course. But hopefully it won't have affected them too much. And yes, if any test takers are listening by any chance, stay strong.
Yes.
It's almost over.
Yes.
And we hope it goes well. Okay, moving on. What else is set to happen next week, Mark?
On Sunday, the Doosan Bears will face off against the KT Wiz in Game 1 of the Korean Series of the Korea Baseball Organization. 2 p.m. is first pitch, and the best-of-seven series will be held at Gocheok Sky Dome. It's going to be quite the matchup. Doosan will compete for a championship for a record 7th time in a row. Will they be able to grab a 4th title in their 7th consecutive attempt? Well, meanwhile, it'll be the Wiz's first title bout in the history of their young existence. Funnily enough, it's just been 7 seasons, so... The amount of time that the Wiz has been alive, they've seen Doosan go to the championship. So let's see if they can get it.
Yeah.
Now, to casual fans like myself, you'd initially think that the more experienced Doosan would have an edge here. But however, we have to remember the Wiz is the regular season champ, while the 4th-seeded Bears, they had to fight tooth and nail to get to the series.
Yeah, so it's going to be a fascinating series. We'll have an update on the first game on Monday in our weekly sports roundup with Yu Ji-ho. So we'll see who has gotten the early upper hand there and try to figure out how the rest of the series will go. Okay, let's squeeze in one more before we go. What else?
U.S. President Joe Biden and Chinese President Xi Jinping are expected to hold a virtual meeting next Monday. The U.S. and China reached an agreement in principle to hold the meeting during talks between U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan and China's top diplomat Yang Jiechi in the Swiss city of Zurich. While the two have held phone talks in February and September, it'll be the first official summit between the two leaders since Biden took office in January.
Yes, with the current tensions between the two superpowers, all eyes will be on that meeting. Right, that's all for next week from Seoul. Mark, thank you for that roundup, and we'll see you next week.
See you then.
And we wrap up another week here on Korea 24 there. Join us again on Monday, where we'll do it all over again, bring you the latest updates and analysis of key events from Korea throughout the week. Until then, we hope you have a great weekend. I've been your host, Kwon Jang-ho, and thank you, as always, for listening. Goodbye.